I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Candace Millard is with us, author right now of Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and The Making of Winston Churchill. She's also the author of several other books. I know that many of you have read Destiny of the Republic. It was my favorite book of whatever year it came out, which was probably about 5 years ago. I recommended it to so many friends, and they all loved it as well. Her first book was The River of Doubt, Theodore Roosevelt's Darkest Journey. It was a New York Times bestseller and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times, Washington Post, San Francisco Chronicle, Christian Science Monitor, Kansas City Star, Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and The Murder of a President was also a bestseller. Her writing has appeared in the Washington Post Book World, New York Times Book Review, Time Magazine. And we're delighted to have her with us to tell this story about Winston Churchill in his early years, his time in the Boer War, his fighting in four wars when he was a very young guy in his early 20s, and what he thought he might be someday, and how going to war and being heroic would help him on his path to a brilliant political future. And we're going to welcome phone calls for Candace. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Candace, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for doing another book. I just love Destiny of the Republic. I've recommended that book to so many people over the years, and it's just terrific. And I'm so glad that you have another book. You've said, I've heard you say, that it takes you about 5 years, because doing a book like what you've done now takes one heck of a lot of research, doesn't it?
It does. It takes a lot of research. But to be honest, that's my favorite part. Mm. So that's kind of a nice coincidence. Yeah, I spend, the first year and a half just doing very basic research, just casting a wide net, going to archives, libraries, museums, and then traveling to where the story unfolded and sort of experiencing it for myself to the extent that I can. And so I don't know often what I'm going to come back with, but then I spend at least another year sorting through it all and trying to absorb it, understand it, organize it, outline it, kind of figure out how I'm going to tell the story. I always find holes in my research. I go back and do more research. So I'm a good, 2.5-3 years in before I even begin to think about writing.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the state of the British Empire when this story takes place. When Winston Churchill is a young guy, he's in his 20s, and the empire is so, so large, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is the height of the British Empire. They ruled 450 million people.
Wow.
And I think about a quarter of the world population. And they were spread incredibly, incredibly thin, because part of being an empire is putting down a lot of revolts. So they were putting down revolts from everywhere, from Ireland to Egypt. And Churchill was born into the middle of this. You know, he's born into the highest ranks of British aristocracy during the Victorian period. You know, the British Empire was actually larger than the Roman Empire at its height. So he feels this very strongly. He's an unabashed imperialist throughout his life. And it represents, or it offers him, a lot of opportunities in the way of war, which he thinks is his vehicle to fame and eventually political power.
And why is he an unabashed imperialist?
So, as I said, he's a direct descendant of the first Duke of Marlborough. If you've heard of Blenheim Palace, he was actually born there. Queen Anne gave the land to, and the title to, John Churchill in the early 1700s after he won the Battle of Blenheim. And he's the son of Lord Randolph Churchill, who was the third son of the seventh Duke, and he had been Chancellor of the Exchequer. He had been leader of the House of Commons. So everywhere Churchill looks, there is incredible pride in the British Empire, both in its breadth, its vastness, but also his understanding of it is that it does good in the world. You know, it brings these colonies' prosperity as this benevolent hand, and he's very proud of it, and he wants to be part of saving it.
Mm-hmm. Ironically, you talk about his views concerning the Dutch and the French and those who were involved in South Africa at the time of the Boer War, and the Boers, who he describes as intolerant, and the Brits as being much more tolerant, although they fail to put into practice what it is that they say they're going to do afterward. Mm-hmm. But really, nobody having much of a sense of all of these people, and you outline them in the book, who were there long before the Boers were there and long before the Brits were there. There were people there.
Right, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because it was very important to me to tell the story to the extent that I could from the point of view of the native Africans, because as you say, so here's this white man's war, the British Empire against the Boers, who were largely German, Dutch, and Huguenot descendants. Who had been immigrants, who had been living in South Africa for centuries, but not for, you know, hundreds or even thousands of years, but for millions of years, people had been living there, and especially in southern Africa, you had the Khoi, the San, the Bantu people, who were both the Zulu and the Xhosa. The Xhosa was where Nelson Mandela's tribe one day. And so these are, you know, very complex, interesting societies had been there for a long, long time, and here are these white men fighting over the land. Both feel very strongly that this is their land. The British believe they are owed it as part of their empire, and the Boers, who are, as well as being, you know, very racist, were also very religious and believed that God had given them this land. And so, again, I obviously that needs to be acknowledged. I wanted to talk about how the Native Africans were forced to take part in this war, how they suffered in this war, mm-hmm. and in particular, I was interested. I found this man, Solomon Plaikie, who would later become the first secretary of the ANC, the African National Congress, and was one of these extraordinary characters. You know, he's largely self-taught. He spoke 8 different European languages, as well as all the other African languages. He translated for Native Africans. He started newspapers, and he wrote a diary during the Boer War, watching these two sides fight. And it's beautifully written, and it's very, very illuminating.
Hmm. The other one who was a beautiful writer was Winston Churchill. I was interested in what Arthur Conan Doyle had to say about Churchill that you write about, that he was considered one of the best writers, best war correspondents, certainly around.
And he absolutely was. You know, we talked about earlier, I did a lot of research, and part of that was reading a lot of newspaper accounts that were written at the time about the Boer War. And Winston Churchill had been a war correspondent. He's 24 years old, but he's already been a correspondent in Cuba right before the Spanish-American War, in British India during the Siege of Malacan, in Sudan during the Battle of Omdurman. So he had covered all of these. He was already a very experienced correspondent, and that's how he made a living. You know, he was born in Blenheim Palace, but he didn't have any income. He hadn't inherited the palace or the title. That's how he supported himself and would support himself for the rest of his life, was through his writing. And if you compare his articles to anybody else's, he is head and shoulders above. It's not just his coverage, which is incredible. He always threw himself in the most difficult and dangerous situations, or even his analysis, but it's really the beauty of his prose. It's really, really striking. And so when he goes to South Africa to cover the war as a correspondent, he is the highest paid correspondent England has ever had, and he deserves it.
Mm-hmm. And it's pretty much money, isn't it? Like $150,000 or something for 4 months?
Yes, yeah. They gave him a lot of money, and he was also very savvy about it. You know, he had gotten an offer from somebody else, and he reached out to another publisher. He's like, "Hey, I've got this offer, but I think, you know, you and I know you could probably do better." And of course, they do. So he works it. You know, he needs that money, and he also, on top of what he's paid, he has this incredible allowance for buying all these kinds of things that he either needs or thinks he needs. And of course, being Winston Churchill, he brings along his valet and all of this, you know, alcohol, this wine, and this, you know, I think it was like 18 bottles of 10-year-old Scotch whiskey to he's willing to risk his life, but he doesn't necessarily want to be uncomfortable.
Yeah, of course. Who would want to be uncomfortable?
No.
Where did he learn the skill of writing the way he did?
Well, so he says it all came out of the fact that he wasn't a good student. And we've all heard those stories about what a terrible student Winston Churchill was. He ends up being brilliant. And it's true to some extent. I mean, he was always at the bottom of his form in his classes. And so I know he talks about how they didn't think he was smart enough to take the Greek or Latin classes. And so they sort of put him in the bonehead English classes. And he had this incredible teacher. And he learned the English language very, very well, and he used it, both to further his own career and, as an incredible skill and weapon later in life as a leader of his country.
Hmm. And where did he get it? Yeah, what was amazing to me is to read early on in your book of all of his encounters, in all of these other wars in Sudan and Cuba and what is now modern-day Pakistan, where he was in some incredibly dangerous situations. I understand that when you're young, you don't realize what could happen to you. But he must have, on some level, realized with bullets flying all around him that he could take one of them, right?
Absolutely. So he was fascinated by war from a very young age. He's this direct descendant of the first Duke of Marlborough, who's considered one of the greatest generals in British history. He has 1,500 toy soldiers as a child that he's always playing with. War is everywhere around him because of all the colonial conflicts. And what he sees is this opportunity, this path to power. He called war sort of, and the medals that you could win there, the glittering gateway to distinction. And so that's where he throws himself again and again, not just into these wars, but into the most dangerous situations. He sought out the most brutal battles that the British Empire had to offer. And even, as you probably know, in British India, he rides a white pony on the battlefield so he'll be noticed. And everyone around him is appalled, both because it's so dangerous and also it's just not done in the British military. You don't brag and you don't push yourself forward. He was called a medal hunter, a young whippersnapper, pushful the younger. And he was. He was incredibly ambitious, and he wasn't shy about it.
Yeah. A lot of people didn't like him, but he did have those along the way who did like him. They thought he was smart and he was a great talker, but a lot of people really thought he was brash and pretty obnoxious, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did, and they did. And it's funny because in so many ways, you're talking about my first book, River of Doubt, he reminds me of Theodore Roosevelt so much. They're both burning with ambition. They're both sort of, they don't care how arrogant they are, how they are perceived. And again and again and again, while I was doing research, I would find these people who would say, oh my gosh, I cannot stand that kid, Winston Churchill. He's going to be prime minister one day, but I can't stand him.
Oh, that's funny. And did they meet, Teddy Roosevelt and Winston Churchill met briefly, didn't they, in Cuba? Was that where it was?
They actually met in the United States. So after the Boer War, Churchill went on a speaking tour and he met Roosevelt. And they didn't like each other. And I really think it was because they were too much alike.
Hmm. So he sees these brave things that he's going to do in battle as his way to have a political life. Does he run for the parliament? Does that election take place before the Boer War, in which he loses and so he has to go on another conquest?
Yes, right. So he's been in these three wars, and he thinks that's enough. This isn't happening fast enough for me. I'm ready for my political debut. And so he actually leaves the military, even though that's the only job he's ever had, the only job for which he's been trained, his only source of income. He leaves, and he runs for parliament, and he loses. And he realizes that he's leaped too soon and that he needs another war, another opportunity to prove himself and to sort of launch his own name on his own back, not on the strength of his father's name, but the strength of his own great deeds of bravery and daring. And so when the Boer War begins, he sees that as his opportunity.
Mm. You have to tell us a little bit about his mom, because she's quite a character, and she campaigns for him in that first election.
Yes, she is. So she's was an incredibly beautiful American socialite named Jenny Jerome, and she's sort of the sparkling center of London society, and Churchill adored her, but as he said, from a distance, because, you know, he was sent to boarding school at a very young age. His father, who was very hard on him, actually, but was also very busy with his own political career. His mother was very busy with her social life, and they just never visited him. It's really heartbreaking to read his letters begging them to come see him. But then when his father dies, when he was about 20 years old, when Churchill was, and he's now a man, and he's interesting, and she takes an interest in him, and she has all these relationships and all this influence with very powerful men, including the Prince of Wales and the Prime Minister and many people in the military, and he says, look, you have to help me. I need to get to all these different wars. I want to go where things are happening so I can do something great and get medals and get noticed. He tells her, you know, this is a pushing age and we must push with the best. And she does. She helps him again and again and again throughout his career. But unfortunately for Churchill, when he's getting ready to go to South Africa, Jenny tells him that she's going to marry again. And she's going to marry this young man named George Cornwallis West, who is just 2 weeks older than her.
Oh, man. Isn't that incredible?
So you can imagine how he feels about it. And he and his younger brother, Jack, are trying to stop it. And George's family are horrified, too, and they're trying to stop it. But when Jenny wanted something, she got something. And they did get married.
Wow. Wasn't it a scandal?
Yeah, it was a scandal, but she didn't care. She just didn't care. You know, she would do what she wanted, and you'll be shocked to hear it didn't last. The marriage didn't last, but then she went on to marry another younger man, and anyway, she got what she wanted.
Anyway, and he fell in love with, what was her name, Pamela? What was her last name?
Yes,
in India.
Pamela Plowden, the great love of his life, the first great love. Clementine, obviously, was the greatest, but the first love of his life. He met her in India, and she was incredibly beautiful and intelligent and charming, and he wanted to marry her, and the great story is that her father wouldn't let her marry him because he didn't think that Churchill would amount to anything.
No, he was prescient, wasn't he?
You gotta love. Yeah.
Wow. We welcome phone calls for Candace. I know that the book is just released, but a lot of you know a lot about Winston Churchill, I'm sure. But this particular chapter is one that she has a real gift for finding these moments in history where you've got cross currents of all these people we know something about, and there they are together, or it's a time in somebody's life, and she really zeroes in on how the essence of the person is formed during a particular time. And for Winston Churchill, those early years are just, it was dumbfounding to me to realize all he had done when he was in his early 20s, and how this particular year when he was captured and spent time in prison and then escaped and climbed over this huge fence by himself and was on his own, this great adventure that was filled with possibility of being killed or captured again. It's an amazing story. And so she has studied the period very, very thoroughly, as you can tell, and takes her time with all kinds of narratives, you know, from notes and diaries and writings from the people involved. So it's all historic. The book is Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and the Making of Winston Churchill. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, feel free to do so, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We do want to let you know that Candace is going to be at a book event Wednesday, October 5 at 7 o'clock at Boswell Books here in Milwaukee. And she'll give a great reading, I'm sure, and more discussion about this time in history. And you're certainly invited to be there on October 5. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Candace, and we start with Gary in Middleton. Hi, Gary.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you both today?
Fine, you?
Hi. I am well.
Good.
I just wanted to tell Candace, I just finished Hero of the Empire last night.
Oh, wow.
I enjoyed it immensely, as I have enjoyed all three of your books now. Being something of a fan and student of Churchill and Roosevelt, they were just great reads. And I was wondering, what's next on the agenda?
Oh, she's
That's
taking...
a big question. I wish I could answer that. I have three favorites. I do have some ideas, and there's one in particular I'm hoping. But I just haven't had time to do the research that it takes to commit to an idea because, you know, you have to have all these different things. You have to have, you know, a really strong central story. Yeah, it has to be able to sort of carry with it larger ideas and themes, whether it's, you know, evolution in the Amazon or the modernization of warfare in South Africa. And most of all, you have to have a ton of primary source material, like so much that you're drowning in it, that you think you'll never get through it. You know, you have to have just an abundance of letters and diaries and newspaper accounts so that you can have dialogue and so that you can have a really rich and deep understanding of the subject. And so you can hopefully have all those little details that you hope will bring the story alive for a reader. So that's a long way of saying I'm working on it.
Okay. I'm so impressed by the research that you do. The research you did for Era of the Empire was fantastic. How long did it take you to research that book?
It took me a couple of years. It took me, so I did a lot of research in England, obviously. I spent some time at the Churchill Archives in Cambridge, which are just incredible, really, really well done. I went to Blenheim Palace, where he was born. I went to the National Army Museum, the National Archives at Kew. And then I went to South Africa, and I spent several weeks there. I think in the United States, not many people remember the Boer War, but obviously in South Africa, it's everywhere. Everywhere you look are battlefield markers and memorials and libraries and museums. But then specifically to this story, I went to where Churchill was captured, where he was kept in a POW camp in Pretoria. It's the same building. It's now a public library. It's just incredible. There's a map on the war on the wall, charting the course of the war that the officer prisoners drew. There's a trap door in the floor where Churchill in the room where Churchill was kept. And I stood in this. You can see where they had thought about at one point trying to tunnel their way out. I went to where he hid in a coal mine shaft. I went to Mozambique, and it was in Portuguese East Africa, and that's where he made his way to freedom, and to the British consulate where he went, and it's, again, it's the same building that he went to, and there's a little plaque on the wall that signifies it as Churchill's garden.
And how did?
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Gary.
I'll finish up and let you move on. Thank you very much for your books, and I'm looking forward to the next one.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.
Give her a little time, though, right, Candace? You got your hands full.
It takes me a while.
Yeah. And you have three children, too.
I do.
You're a pretty busy woman.
Yeah, pretty busy.
Yeah. South Africa, I didn't know you had gone to all those places in preparation for the book. How do you find South Africa these days? Is there more of a semblance of everybody getting along?
I think South Africa is struggling. You know, they're changing. But, you know, there's a lot of good change, obviously. You know, the Boers that I write about were the precursors to the Afrikaners and apartheid and all of that.
Yeah.
Horrible, dark history for the country. And, you know, the British Empire, as you mentioned earlier, made all these promises, you know, once we've won the war, things will be better for Native Africans. And obviously they weren't. And it took a long time until we got to Nelson Mandela, unfortunately. And so they, you know, we've lost Nelson Mandela now, and the country is still changing and trying to find its footing.
Let's go next to Paul in Tomahawk. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
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 How did Winston Churchill experience in Africa, well, South Africa, the Boer War? How was that influenced with his experience from the Sudan? Because that was his first experience with war.
Well, he actually, so he had been, he had gone as an observer. He had gone to the beginnings of the Spanish-American War in Cuba, and then he went to British India, and mostly fighting with in the siege of Malacan, and then he had gone to Sudan and Omdurman, and so all of those things sort of fed into his fascination with war and his belief that war would be the way he would sort of propel himself to power. But South Africa cemented everything. So South Africa proved to him everything that he believed about himself. He believed that he was destined for greatness. He believed that he was special, even extraordinary, and that he was incredibly resourceful and incredibly capable. And he proved it again and again and again in South Africa. And he did these things alone. You know, his escape was something he did alone. And all of that fed into who we think of when we think of Winston Churchill. You know, you can see when you look at him in South Africa, you can see all these qualities that are, you know, very important, not just to him and to his country, but to his allies during World War II. You see his determination, you see his audacity, you see his brilliance, his ingenuity, his grit, his agility. They all come to the fore in South Africa.
Hmm. And let's talk about the opposition. Let's talk about the Boers a little bit more, about who they were, what fierce, fierce fighters they are that you write about, and how the British really didn't anticipate how effective they were going to be.
So, as I mentioned earlier, they've been in South Africa for centuries, and in that time, all that they did largely was fight and hunt. So they were constantly, you know, at war, often with the Zulu. They were, you know, fighting and hunting lions, and so they, as you might imagine, were incredibly skilled marksmen. They didn't have a standing army. They didn't have a paid army. They wouldn't call themselves soldiers. They were burghers, meaning citizens. And so they didn't have uniforms even. They wore the same sort of dusty, drab, gray, and brown clothes that they wore every day of their lives, which, as you might imagine, is exactly the colors surrounding them in the South African veld. So they disappeared into the veld. And so for the British, you know, they're not at all prepared for this war. They think this is going to be another little colonial war. Mm-hmm. It starts in October. It'll certainly be over by Christmas. No big deal. We're the British Army. What hope do these backward Boers have of defeating us? And they were shocked. They were losing the war very early on. They lost large battle after large battle because they had just begun to drag themselves into the modern world, their army. You know, they called this the Khaki War because they had only just given up their dashing red coats, and which they sort of bitterly resented giving up. They thought the new uniforms made them look like bus drivers. But they were still fighting in these perfect, precise lines, you know, just laid out for the slaughter for the Boers. And it took them a long time, but slowly, and this war lasted almost 3 years, slowly they began to learn from the Boers and to change their tactics. And this prepared them for World War I.
Mm. And when you say it was a precursor to World War I, some of the issues were a precursor to World War I, or what do you mean?
So, I mean, it changed. The British Army that goes into the Boer War is completely different from the British Army that comes out of it. And it's really interesting to watch it happen, and you can kind of see it happening as it's discussed by the journalists who are covering the war. Obviously, Winston Churchill, Rudyard Kipling was there, covering the war. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, he was there as a doctor, but he would later write one of the definitive histories of the war. And there's this guy named George Warrington Stevens. I found absolutely fascinating. He's probably the only journalist at the time who could compete with Churchill in his prose. And he was almost a poet, this guy, but he was also incredibly insightful. And he was under siege in Ladysmith. That was when Churchill arrived. That was the front for the war, and the Boers had it surrounded, and Churchill was trying to get in, but you couldn't. It was locked down. And George Warrington Stevens was in, and he had been watching the war. He had been there even before Churchill. And he said, in his dispatches, he said, you know, slowly I think that we're finally beginning to learn how to fight, and we're learning it from our enemy.
Hmm. Let's go next to Jackie. Paul, thanks for your call. Jackie in Arena. Hi, Jackie.
Hello, Kathleen. I just wanted to share a little story. Winston Churchill's leadership style was quite unique. My late in-laws, British in-laws, were photographers in the military in the Second World War. They met in the Second World War. And they were part of a very small team of people that produced the aerial photographs for the D-Day landing.
Oh, wow.
And they didn't know what they were preparing for or anything. It was a very secretive mission. Within days of the landing happening, they each received, and every member of the small team received, a handwritten note from Winston Churchill thanking them for their work, because everybody would see the heroism of the soldiers in the passé news reports and so on, but nobody would ever know about the work that they did, and he wanted to personally acknowledge their contribution.
What a great story. That fits, you know. He knew the power of actually seeing something play out, you know, understanding sort of the danger and peril that was involved with war, and the power of the fame that can propel you to prominence, to public prominence, because of, you know, your daring or your bravery on the battlefield or in the midst of a war. And he understood that at a very young age. So that all fits. That's really interesting.
And you write about his remembering his time of imprisonment in the Boer War, and that he became kind to prisoners that he was keeping as a result of those experiences he had, right?
That's right. Later on, he became Home Secretary. And he hated his imprisonment, even though the Boers went out of their way to treat their, at least their officer prisoners, very well, because they bristled at the idea of the British sort of, you know, saying, oh, they're so backward and they're so crude, and so they wanted to show them that they too were civilized, and so they actually treated the prisoners well, but Churchill hated imprisonment. He actually said that he hated this period of his life more than he had ever hated any other moment in his life, and his whole life. And he, from the moment he was captured, he was planning his escape. And he always remembered that. His whole life, he always remembered sort of the humiliation and the frustration and the despair that came with being a prisoner. And he said that, you know, no matter what someone has done, no matter how horrendous their crime, they still must live this often, you know, for the rest of their lives in this imprisonment, and they're human beings. And so he made sure that they had books, that they had access to exercise, that they had access to the outdoors, and because of his own experiences in the Boer War.
Mm. Thank you, Jackie. So really nice
Thank
to
you,
hear
Jackie.
From you. Brian in Eau Claire. Hello, Brian.
Yeah, hi, girls. One that you were talking about how the British were prepared for World War One after the Boer War. During the early stages when the BEF landed on the continent, the Germans were astounded by the fact that they had run into an infantry rifle company instead of a machine gun company, because after the Boer, as a result of the British colonial expansion, and particularly the Boer War, the British Army and BEF were considered the best riflemen in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And there's affidavits on file from some of the German soldiers at that time that they couldn't believe that they hadn't run into a German machine gun company instead of a rifle company.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, I think that the British Empire was shocked to find themselves losing the war, and they did learn so much. And they also, you know, to their amazement, they found that they had that the Boers had superior weapons, even, and they had, you know, smokeless gunpowder was still a pretty new a new invention as well, which made it absolutely impossible to see their enemy. And so sort of understanding that and adapting to that was essential to their survival in World War One.
Mm. I want to talk a little bit more about some of the people, because there were some amazing people who came to South Africa to care for the people who were living there, the native Africans and also the Indians. Gandhi, certainly, you also write about this. Solomon Plachtchi, is that how you pronounce it?
Plaikie,
yes. Who was a linguist and who was the first secretary of the African National Congress. Mm-hmm. So there, all of this was happening at the same time. And poor South Africa, the people living there just went through horrendous conditions for so long mm-hmm. after this. So it's a double question. Why was there so much harshness, horrible treatment of native Africans and Indians by the Boers? Where did those ideas really come from? And B, who was trying to come to their rescue, people like Gandhi?
So the Boers believed, again, they were very religious, and they believed that God had given them this land, and they were highly racist. In fact, the British Empire's choice to abolish slavery in 1833 was the jumping-off point, was the impetus for what was called the Great Trek. So many of the Boers had been living in the Cape, and so just 2 years after the British Empire abolished slavery, they moved hundreds of miles into the African interior in what was called the Great Trek, and that's when they established their three independent republics, and one of them was the Transvaal, which is also known as the South African Republic, and that's where much of the fighting took place during the Boer War. And so they believed that they were much better than Native Africans. They believed that God had made Native Africans to be their servants. And so they know there were horrible prejudice against them, horrible treatment of them. Even Lord Randolph Churchill, who was Churchill's father, who had gone to South Africa about 8 years before the Boer War, and he was this incredibly elitist political figure, but he excoriated the Boers for their treatment of Native Africans, and he wrote openly about that, and the Boers hated him for it. But you're right, so they're often in situations like that, there are people who try to make a difference, and one of them was Gandhi. Gandhi, I think people often forget, so he was sort of a frustrated, failing lawyer, and he went to South Africa to try to be more successful in his career, and he was astonished by the treatment, not just of Native Africans, but obviously of the Indian population in South Africa, who were treated not much better than Africans by the Boers. And he found there is when he discovered his extraordinary ability to organize, and he developed all of his ideas of nonviolent resistance that then were passed down to we see it in Martin Luther King Jr. We see it in Nelson Mandela. So that's where all these ideas were developed. And so during the Boer War, which was a time when he was still trying to get the attention of the British Empire and tell them, look, the Indians deserve better treatment, they deserve more rights. And he thought, okay, we need to help the British Empire during the Boer War. But he didn't want to fight, obviously, so he organized a group of stretcher bearers. And it's extraordinary to think that Gandhi was on the same battlefield as Winston Churchill.
Goodness.
During the Boer War.
It sure is. We're welcoming phone calls. Our guest this hour has written another book, Hooray, Hooray, because her last was just fabulous. Candace Millard, the book is Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and the Making of Winston Churchill. Her last book was Destiny of the Republic, and before that she wrote The River of Doubt. Our phone number is 800, thanks for the call, Brian, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655. Well, we haven't talked at all, and I think we probably should during the course of the hour about his capture and also the daring escape, which is how you start the book. And it's quite a gripping story, Candace.
Thank you. For those who don't know the basic story, it really is just extraordinary. You can't, I mean, it would be this spectacular adventure had it happened to anybody, but the fact that it happened to Winston Churchill is just mind-blowing. So he's in South Africa to cover the war as a correspondent. He climbs aboard an armored train, even though he knows it's a crazy thing to do. The armored trains are incredibly, ridiculously easy targets for the Boers. They're on a track, and when they go, they know that they're going to come back, and they can attack them, and that's what happens. So Churchill's on this train, the Boers attack it, and it really shows how he was just a born leader. He's 24 years old.
Yeah.
He's not even a member of the military. He's one of the few civilians on the train, and when they come under attack, he instantly takes charge and begins running around in this hailstorm of bullets and shells, giving orders, telling everybody else what to do. And, you know, there are legitimate uniformed soldiers on this train. It's full of them. And their commander is there right there. And the amazing thing is that everybody listens. They do exactly what this young correspondent is telling them to do. And the train gets away with many of the cars. Several men die in the process. Many are horribly wounded. Mm. Many are captured, including Churchill. But those who make it out alive, every single one of them, and you can read the newspaper accounts, they credit Winston Churchill's bravery and resourcefulness for saving their lives. Unfortunately, Churchill himself was captured, and he was taken to Pretoria, and he was put in this POW camp, and he's furious, and he's outraged, and he's determined to escape and to regain his freedom so he can return to the war. And he finds, being Winston Churchill, his first ideas are, you know, of these, like, grand, grand schemes. You know, he's not just going to quietly escape himself. He's going to, you know, take over the whole prison, and then he's going to take over the prison where the soldiers are, and then he's going to take over Pretoria, and he's going to capture the president, and he's going to end the war.
Right.
And everyone else in the prison is like, yeah, you know, go do something else, kid. Get out of my way. And so he overhears these two men, one of whom is his friend, and was actually the guy who was a commander on the train and had invited him to join him on the train. And this other guy named Adam Brocky, who was this very scrappy guy who spoke Afrikaans, who spoke Zulu, who knew the region really well. And they had this idea that they had been watching carefully, and at night when the electric lights came on, there was one corner of the prison yard. There was a 6.5-foot tall iron paling, and there was one corner that remained dark. And they noticed that if the armed guards who were constantly patrolling, if one of them turned his back at the right moment, they could get over the fence. And so that was their plan. Churchill overhears them and says that he wants to go along with them. And they both say, absolutely not. You know, first of all, you talk too much. You're going to tell everybody the plan. Secondly, you're too famous. They're going to notice right away that you're gone. Mm-hmm. And then finally, you're not strong enough. They didn't think he could make it. I mean, it's almost 300 miles of enemy territory stretching between the prison and freedom in Portuguese East Africa. And so they tell him no. But Almer Halden, who is his friend, feels bad. He feels like it's kind of my fault that he was captured. And so he says, look, just so you know, we don't want you to come with us, but I'll leave it up to you because I feel guilty about it. And Churchill, being Churchill again, is like, I'm coming. I don't care if you want me to or not. I'm going to come with you. And as fate would have it, only he makes it over the wall.
Isn't that something?
And they're stuck behind.
Yeah, and then he has to do this incredible journey by himself.
By himself.
Wow.
And he doesn't have anything, too. They have all the provisions. He doesn't have a map. He doesn't have a compass. He doesn't have food. He doesn't have a weapon. He doesn't speak the language. It's really just extraordinary
that he
made it out alive.
Yeah. Kathy is our next caller for you in Lac de Flambeau. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
Hi.
My question is, I'm wondering if you'd researched the Native American background of the mother on the Jerome side. I know that there was a story within the family that there was Native American blood, and there is a famous explorer, Francois Jerome, that was around back in the 1700s when the Northwest Passage search was going on. So I was just curious if you found anything.
Yes, she has.
I did. I did just run into basically what you just described, that there was some understanding that there was Native American blood in the family, and obviously at that time it wasn't something that they were proud of. It's actually something that they tried to hush up. You know, today it would be fantastic, and you would be telling everybody you know that you have this lineage. Unfortunately, that wasn't true at the time. And there's some discussion about it. I believe it was believed to be Iroquois, but as far as I know, it's never been validated. So we don't know. It's not been confirmed.
Thank you very much for your call, Harry in Madison. Hi.
Yes, hi. Thanks for having me on the program. I wanted to ask the author if she ran across Mary Kingsley, who was a nurse. Mary Kingsley, the niece of Charles Kingsley, who was a nurse in the World War, if she and Churchill ever met or she ran across him. And also, she would be a good subject for your next book.
She would. That's so interesting. You know, I don't know if she and Churchill met. Mary Kingsley, though, is somebody I'm very interested in and admire very much. Actually, when I was working at National Geographic, I always wanted to do a story on her. And for those of you who don't know, she was this Victorian spinster. She had, you know, lived with her parents most of her life. And then when they died, she decided she was going to set out into the world. And she became an explorer. And she went to Africa in her big hoop skirts, you know, making her way across Africa in very difficult and dangerous situations again and again. And she wrote about it. She became friends with Rudyard Kipling, and just a fascinating character. And unfortunately, she did go to the Boer War to serve as a nurse, and she died there. She, I believe, died from typhoid fever.
Thank you, Harry, for your call and suggestion for Candace's next book. Patricia in La Crosse, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I just can't believe it. I just happened to turn on the radio and started listening to this story, and it was so compelling.
Thank you.
Goodness.
You okay?
Yeah, are you there, Patricia?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. And I didn't realize it was the same woman who wrote Garfield. Which I just finished and enjoyed so much. I couldn't believe I missed that whole piece of history. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I'll just say really quickly that I really love it when people tell me that they've read and enjoyed the book about James Garfield.
Yes.
Because he was so forgotten by history. And to me, that's sort of the secondary tragedy to his story, because he was such an extraordinary man. And I really think would have been one of our great presidents had he lived.
And I love the fact that you brought him back. I didn't think much of anything about James Garfield until you wrote Destiny of the Republic, and now he comes up in conversation all the time, Candace. You did that single-handedly.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, it's a good thing.
My honor.
Yeah, and just in about 45 seconds, what led you to Winston Churchill? Because obviously you can write about so many things, but why this story?
Well, I had heard this story actually 25 years ago, and it always stayed with me. And after I turned in the manuscript for Garfield, I looked back at it, and I realized that this genuinely is the making of Winston Churchill. Not only did it launch his political career, but it confirmed so much that he had always believed about himself. And we can see his true nature here on the felt, both and, you know, his incredible heroics when he was under attack with the armored train, and as he's trying to, and sort of desperate and scared and alone and without help and very little hope on this incredible trek across the South African veld. I think you can see him so clearly. And the added fact that this is the beginning of modern warfare, it was just this incredibly compelling story to me, and I'm so grateful to have had the opportunity to research it and tell it. I'm going to miss Churchill after I move on to a different subject.
Mm. Well, just reread your book, Candace.
Yeah.
That's all you have to do. It'll be right there on the shelf. Thank you so much for being with us, really. Thanks.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
So did I. Candace Millard, the book is Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and the Making of Winston Churchill. Candace will be at a book event, book signing, and a reading on Wednesday, October 5 at 7 o'clock at Boswell Books here in Milwaukee. And she's fun to meet and really one beautiful, beautiful writer. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers and KP Whaley for producing and doing on-air production for this particular program. And thank you very much for listening. And thanks to Candace for all her books.